Okay, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Bill. So thank you for staying. It's been a long and exciting day. And we have, as the capstone for the day, a very distinguished speaker, Bill Daly, who I'm sure many of you know. And Bill's going to talk to us about efficiency and programmability, the challenges for future computing. Bill, of course, is an extremely well-known academic who's made a huge impact in areas of computer architecture, parallel computing, and parallel mechanisms for computing. He's currently the chief scientist and senior vice president of research at NVIDIA. He's also a professor at Stanford and the former chair of the computer science department. He and I were up here talking about all of the different systems he built, including the Bellmac 32 and the Mars system at Bell Labs, and the MOSM simulation engine, the Taurus routing chip as a graduate student at Caltech, the J machine and the M machine at MIT, Imagine and Elm at Stanford, and probably a half a dozen chips in there, you know, that don't even make it to this level, so it's pretty extraordinary. Bill, of course, is a member of the National Academy of Engineering. He's a fellow of the ACM, the IEEE, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and has won numerous awards in architecture, such as the Eckert-Mauchly Award, the Seymour Cray Award, the Maurice Wilkes Award, and recently the FUNAI, I don't know how to pronounce that, or even if you do pronounce that, Achievement Award for Computer Architecture. So with that, let me welcome Bill Daly.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Let me give your presentation in my mind here. Use one mouse. So it's a really exciting time to be a computer architect. Because the work we do has great impact on society, and also because most of the value delivered in future computing systems is due to the architect, not to due to the process engineer or better technology. So the first thing I want to impress upon you is that the computers that we use really are critically important to all sorts of endeavors. If you were around in the late 1800s and you wanted to do great science, you built a telescope, and the people who had the biggest telescopes made the best astronomical discoveries. In the mid-20th century, people built particle accelerators, and if you had the highest energy particle accelerator, you made the best particle physics discoveries. Today, the people with the biggest computer make the best discoveries because so much of science is being done on computers. So if you go around the corners of this chart, at the upper left is a sort of visualization of a climate simulation, and both daily weather forecasting, which has gotten quite good, as well as climate models that are predicting how badly we're damaging our planet with greenhouse gas emissions, are actually critically dependent on high-performance computers to do their simulation. Part of what is needed to get accurate simulation are better models, things like cloud radiation is not completely understood yet, but also they need much higher resolution. They need to get down to sub-kilometer grids, which exceeds the capability of the largest machines we have today. So actually building better computers does better climate science. The weather predictions are now so accurate that actually what limits them is the initial conditions, not the ability to integrate forward over a couple days. It's just simply they have too few data points about what the current weather really is. And so in fact, the people who are better at weather, and the Europeans are actually better than we are at this, actually run a estimation program before they run the simulation. They don't just take the measurements from their latest instruments, but they actually adjust those based on a maximum likelihood estimation of what the real initial conditions are based on the previous measurements and previous forecasts of weather. To avoid doing even more damage to our planet, we need to build more efficient engines. The picture at the upper right is a simulation of a combustion process in the design of a clean engine at the Department of Energy. We're trying to understand our biological systems better. This is a photograph of a systems biology simulation. And some things you absolutely could not do in an experiment, for example, colliding galaxies together, you could do on supercomputers. So computing is really enabling science today, and you should think of high-performance computers as being the scientific instruments of our century, like particle accelerators were of the last century and telescopes of the century before that. So what do these things look like? The Titan machine at Oak Ridge National Labs is currently the fastest supercomputer in the United States. You know, a comparable, slightly more modern machine, also based on the same generation of NVIDIA GPUs, is the fastest machine in Europe. Titan is 27 petaflops peak. It sustains about two-thirds of that on real problems, and essentially all of those petaflops are coming from the GPUs in there. About a year ago, we announced with IBM that we were going to build two flagship supercomputers, one at Oak Ridge to replace Titan called Summit and one at Lawrence Livermore called Sierra. And these machines are about an order of magnitude more powerful, going from 30 petaflops to 300 petaflops peak performance. And again, 90% of those petaflops are coming from NVIDIA Volta GPUs that hasn't been announced yet. Titan has Kepler GPUs. We just announced Pascal at the most recent GPU technology conference. Volta is a generation after Pascal. One thing which actually really enables this technology is we've developed our own high-speed interface technology called NVLink and networking based on that. This allows us to tie a number of GPUs and CPUs together in the node and get very, very good performance and particularly sustained performance in applications that require data to be shared between the processors. Now, what a lot of people don't appreciate is when you pull your cell phone out of your pocket and you ask Google a question, you're actually using this same technology. At one point in time when we built computers, we had one set of technology we used to build the fastest machines, and a different set of technology we used to build low-power machines. For a long time in the 1980s, in fact, we built the fastest machines out of bipolar technology and used CMOS technology for low-power machines. Today, we use CMOS technology for all our machines and essentially the same circuits for all of them, because today everything is limited by power, and so our fastest machines use low-power technology, as do our cell phones and mobile devices. At NVIDIA, we also are leading in this respect. Our Tegra X1 processor is a teraflop that you can basically hold in the palm of your hand. To put this in perspective, the fastest machines in the world in the 1990s were teraflop machines. And now we're able to run a teraflop for about 10 watts. And it enables all sorts of interesting embedded applications. One of the ones we're most excited about is trying to reduce the 1.2 million people who are killed on the highways worldwide every year by making driving safer. NVIDIA is at the forefront of sort of the revolution in self-driving and driver-assisted automobiles. We make both hardware and software. This figure shows our Drive PX system. And we have variations of that, that go up to close to a petaflop in performance. The most common ones are more in the order of about 10 to 20 teraflops that power most of the serious efforts in self-driving cars today. These machines are fed by a number of cameras. We have up to 12 cameras in some of the configurations. LIDARs, these are depth cameras that basically do time of flight of laser pulses to basically measure the distance to different things in the environment, sonars and radars, and then take all that information and use it to make decisions about whether to turn the car left or right, apply the brakes, because they recognize, say, a cyclist. They recognize a cyclist or another car or a pedestrian on the road. And this technology really has the potential both to dramatically reduce the number of traffic fatalities worldwide and also to provide mobility to people as they get too old to drive themselves. That won't be an issue. You'll still be able to walk out to your car and just tell your car where to take you. What's really interesting about a lot of the revolution in self-driving cars is it's actually being driven by a much larger and broader revolution in deep neural networks. And what I find very exciting about deep neural networks is it's a technology that's been around for a long time and its time has finally come. The fundamental papers on all of the deep neural networks that people are using today were written in the 1980s. Jan LeCun wrote the paper on convolutional neural networks in 1989. The networks that people are using with very small improvements are based on that exact same model. So what happened between 1989 and 2012 when AlexNet won the ImageNet competition? Well, two enabling conditions were met that didn't exist in 1989. In 1989, when Jan LeCun looked at doing this, there was literally five orders of magnitude less computing performance available than we have today. And training these neural networks is very computationally intensive. So without modern GPUs, it just wasn't possible to do meaningful deep neural network work. It just took too long to train the models. The other thing that existed long before this, so the two things that feed into this are high performance and lots of data. If you don't have enough data, you'll overfit a model. So it took to the point where we would have data sets with millions, and in some cases billions now, of images, to take these very, very deep models and train them without overfitting. And now what we find when we talk to numerous people in the big data center customers is that they have more data than they can afford to train on. There seems to be a constant. People don't want to use more data or a larger network than they can train in a week. So they keep coming back and asking, you know, can't you train our networks faster? Because we'd like to use twice as much data, and that would enable us to have deeper networks with more parameters and hence get better accuracy. But we can't do it if it takes us more than a week to train. So they want their appetite for flops directed at training neural networks is completely insatiable. And it's actually not just a throughput problem. It is a latency problem. They need to solve a single problem faster. It requires strong scaling. So what makes it harder for us to continue to deliver this are two trends, and I'll talk about both of them in the remainder of this talk. The end of Dennard scaling. Let me get a quick show of hands here. How many people have heard the term Dennard scaling before? Okay, so most people, but not all, more than half. The end of Dennard scaling and the move to pervasive parallelism, and they're really quite related. So let me start with the end of Dennard scaling. What Dennard scaling is a rule that says as you scale semiconductor devices, particularly MOSFETs, you basically keep the electric field strength constant. So if you scale linear dimension by a factor of two, you also scale the voltage by a factor of two, so the field strength, the volts per meter, remains the same. Dennard scaling ended around 2005, and I'll explain why. But with it ended the popular notion of something that everybody in this room, I'm sure, knows, which is Moore's Law. The popular version of Moore's Law is that Moore's Law doubles the performance of processors every few years. But this is, in fact, wrong. That's not what Moore's Law says at all. What Moore's Law says is that the number of transistors that you can economically fabricate on one chip increases exponentially over time. The original doubling was every 12 months, and it has been revised, you know, at various points in time to 2 years or 18 months. But just having more transistors doesn't provide more value. It takes other things to turn transistors into value. If you look at, you know, the track of NVIDIA GPUs, and I should put Pascal up there, which is I think 17 billion transistors on a chip, which is be shipping later this year. You know, it's more than just the number of transistors that adds the value. It's both getting less energy per transistor, which lets you use more transistors in the same power envelope, and then having an architecture which takes many parallel transistors and solves one problem faster. But let me go back to the first one of these, which is the energy per transistor. Back in the good old days, every time you scaled the dimensions of a semiconductor part, where typically you would reduce the physical dimensions by a factor of 0.7, so the sort of square root of 2 scaling, you would get twice as many transistors. So here I show the capability of the chip and the power, the capability of the chip, you know, what it can do for you is on the x-axis, and the amount of power it dissipates on the y-axis. So the first approximation, if I double the number of transistors in my chip, it'll do twice as much stuff that moves me along the x-axis, but it'll take me twice as much power. And I typically don't have twice as much power. I'm usually operating a chip in a power envelope that has to remain constant each generation, but wait, I'm not done yet. The next thing that happens is because I've reduced the distance that the electrons have to travel, it can run square root of 2 times faster. So now I'm up to 2.8 times as much capability, but I'm also 2.8 times as much power. But now this is where Dennard scaling comes into play. First, I get 0.7 back because as I reduced all three physical dimensions by 0.7, I've reduced the capacitance by 0.7. But I've also, if I scale the voltage with distance, I've also reduced the voltage by 0.7. I get to square that. I get a factor of 2 on voltage. So back in the good old days of Dennard scaling, which lasted through most of the 1980s and 1990s and through the middle part of the last decade, every time I got a new semiconductor technology, I got 2.8 times as much stuff, almost 3 times as much capability without doing anything, right? If I just built copies of my last processor, I could put 2.8 times as many down on a chip and run that at the same power and get 2.8 times as much throughput on problems. It was truly a great time to be a computer architect. You could basically, you know, count on the process technology to do great things. You could go to the beach and everybody was happy. But then around the middle of the last decade, Another semi-log plot by Gordon Moore. This was from a keynote that Gordon gave at the International Solid State Circuits Conference in 2003. He pointed out that if we continued scaling the voltage, the downside of voltage scaling is that the leakage current increases exponentially as you reduce the threshold voltage of a device. If you scale the supply voltage of the device, you also have to scale the threshold voltage. That causes this exponential increase in leakage current. And he pointed out that the leakage current would get to unsustainable levels, which would completely dominate the power dissipation of our processors if this continued. So what happened is people stopped scaling voltage. There was a long period of time when the design rules of a part and the supply voltage of the part were very simply related. When we had 0.25 micron technology, we ran it at 2.5 volts. Then when we scaled down to 0.18 micron technology, we ran it at 1.8 volts. And this basically gave us constant fields. This continued until we got down to 0.1 micron, 100 nanometer technology, which we ran at 1 volt. But then as we scaled down to 65 nanometer and 45 nanometer, and now we're shipping parts in 16 nanometer, we kept the supply at 1 volt. We didn't scale it down to 160 millivolts, which would have been the old scaling to 16 nanometer. And by doing that, we ended the power advantage of Dennard scaling. So what happens now is that we still get the two times as many transistors, which gives us twice the power. We don't run twice as fast for a number of reasons that I won't go into. We still get that 0.7 back from capacitance. But now we have this problem that we've got twice the capability, but we're running 1.4 times the power dissipation, which we can't afford. So we actually have to run either, so we're no longer out here at 2.8, we're only back at 2, but then in fact, at the same power, we wind up being back at 1.4. And when I actually work the numbers for each new generation of technology we get, due to a number of sort of second order effects that have to do with the difficulty of patterning 16 nanometer lines with 180 nanometer light and other things like that, we don't even get the 1.4x. We actually wind up with something like 1.2x. We get about 20% improvement in capability in a process generation these days compared to 2.8x for most of the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. So this is really summed up very nicely by Bob Caldwell, who at the time was the director of the Microsystems Technology Office at DARPA when he spoke in 2013 at the Design Automation Conference. And that Moore's Law gives us more transistors, and Dennard scaling made them useful, emphasis on the past tense. Another trend that happened about the same time and is related is that instruction level parallelism was mined out around 2000. So if you look at this chart, and I apologize for going downward is better here, which is, everybody says the right way to write charts is upward is better. So just invert this chart in your mind, but I wanted to use the original chart. This is from an ISAT study I led in 2001. And what it shows is performance in picoseconds per instruction, starting in 1980 and scaling to 2020. And the green line is what would happen is if you didn't change the architecture at all, you just put down more parallel processors and you got linear speed up from the parallel processors. The blue line is what we got scaling serial processors through the 80s and 90s, which is a great time to be scaling serial processors because two big veins of performance were available to be mined during that period of time. The first was basically deep pipelining. The original 8086 in 1980 had 100 fan-out of 4 inverter delays per pipeline stage. And you could basically make it run faster by taking one of those pipeline stages and chopping it in half and putting a register there. You could run twice as many instructions through in the same amount of time. By the end of the 90s, though, Intel had their P4 architecture that was 9 fan-out of 4 inverter delays per pipe stage. And they actually double-pumped the arithmetic units at 4.5. And they discovered that they had pushed it too far. It was not a very power-efficient architecture, and they backed off. And most modern processors today are around 20 fan-out of 4 inverter delays per pipe stage. And that vein has been mined out. You're not going to get any more from that. About 20% per year over this period of time, if you plot the individual processors, were due to deeper pipelining. The other thing that you could do while pipelining deeper was to pipeline wider as well. Instead of doing one instruction at a time, you could do multiple instructions at a time. The original 8086 back in 1980 actually took 10 clocks to do one instruction. By the end of the 90s, there were many processors shipping that did 4 instructions per clock at their peak rate. and that is still the peak rate for high-end out-of-order data center processors. So that vein, you got a factor of 40 over those two decades, and another 20% per year, was also mined out. And what we predicted in 2001 then is what was left is this 20% per year from process technology. But in fact, that flattened out in 2005 when Dennard scaling ended, which was not anticipated by this report in 2001. So the result, and this is yet another chart due to Moore, but in this case it was Chuck Moore, who was at the time the CTO of AMD, presenting at the Salishan meeting a few years ago, showing that all these nice curves are flattening out, and particularly this one about single thread performance and number of cores are all flattening out. The thing that's not flattening out is Moore's law, number of transistors. You still get those transistors, but you don't turn them into any more performance. So there are a bunch of takeaway messages from the end of Dennard scaling. The first is, like many of us as we get older, processors aren't getting faster, they're just getting wider. What this means is that future gains in performance are entirely due to parallelism. And this will come back when I talk about the real trend in software is to making everything very parallel. Another thing to take away is that every computer system is energy limited. If you can get more energy efficiency, more performance per watt, you get more performance because the watts are fixed and you're limited by the watts. And the final thing is it's actually a great time to be an architect because architecture really matters. Process generation now gives you a 20% gain, not a 3x gain. It used to be that if you were one generation of process technology behind, almost no amount of cleverness would save you from your competitor being 3x as fast as you were. Now, it doesn't actually take too much cleverness to make up for a 1.2 factor, and a good architecture will trump a more modern process every time. I'll also point out that it's not about the flops. A lot of people say, well, we just need to build better arithmetic units and make them go faster or make the devices go faster. It's not about the flops. It's not about the individual transistors. Most of what limits us in these machines is data movement and overhead. And I'll come to both of those points shortly. But as just an example, if you wanted an exascale machine and the only requirement was that it did 10 to the 18th double precision floating point operations per second and dissipated less than 20 megawatts, which is the original specs for the DOE exascale machine, I could deliver that for you today. In fact, it wouldn't even be much of a stretch. I could on a 10 millimeter chip. This is not to scale. I had to make it larger than scale. You wouldn't be able to see it. This is a double precision fuse multiply add unit. It dissipates about 10 picojoules per op. And I can run it to get 2 gigaflops out of it, basically running it at a gigahertz, and I get both a multiply and an add each cycle. I can put 10 to the fourth of these on a chip. So I can build one 20 teraflop chip that dissipates about 200 watts. If I put 50,000 of these in a rack, I have an exaflop and it's only 10 megawatts. You can use the other 10 megawatts to actually try to shuffle data around. But the point here is that the arithmetic is the easy part of the problem. The hard part of the problem is managing overhead and locality. This is what real architectural progress today is undoing. So to give you an idea of the overhead problem, let me compare a CPU to a GPU. And this is sort of one generation back on both of these, but I will point out that the CPU is a generation of process technology ahead of the GPU. But even so, the CPU is 130 picojoules per flop. And that's if you use its AVX unit, if you use its SIMD parallel unit. If you actually run scalar floating point instructions on the CPU, it's about 1.7 nanojoules per flop. And that is almost entirely due to overhead, because the CPU does an enormous amount of work figuring out what order to do instructions in, to schedule them at runtime, to rename things within the processor core, to predict which way branches are going to go, and all that takes an enormous amount of overhead energy. The GPU, on the other hand, has less overhead energy, although not zero, and it's around 30 picojoule per flop. But remember, the flop itself is around 10, so we're still consuming roughly half the energy on overhead and half on the flops. I will observe that for certain fixed function problems, we can get down to 3 picojoules per op, not necessarily a flop. Very often these fixed function things, one of the optimizations we make to get energy efficiency is moving from floating point to fixed point. But there's yet another order of magnitude to be done by hardwiring certain algorithms, and that's a big opportunity going forward for more energy efficiency. To give you an idea of where the energy goes in all this overhead, Here are pie charts from an efficient embedded processes. This is from a paper I wrote when we were doing our Elm project in 2008. And this is from the DEC Alpha 21264, which is actually still a good proxy for a modern out-of-order processor. And what you see is that AOU here is 4%. But this is actually a very misleading number. That's all the AOUs in the processor. It turns out that the AOUs that are actually doing the payload operation, you know, if you do an add instruction, that's less than 1%. It's about a half a percent. This includes the AOU that does the incrementing of the instruction pointer and the AOUs that are used in the branch predictor. These are all of the AOUs. The actual number is much smaller. So the way to think about it is, in a modern out-of-order processor, which dissipates about a nanojoule per instruction, I'm rounding down, you have about 15 picojoules of payload arithmetic, and that's for a floating point operation, right? If you're doing an integer add, it's more like one picojoule. The remainder of the nanojoule is overhead, and that's where things are not very efficient. The way to see this, and this is, again, from the same paper on the DEC Alpha 21264, is the payload arithmetic is done in these arithmetic units over here, these floating point units and integer AOUs. And they're, especially the integer AOUs, are relatively efficient units. They take maybe 1 to 3 picojoules to perform an operation, depending on what the operation is. Before you get there, you have to read a bunch of tables. It turns out for every instruction you fetch, you predict whether or not it's a branch, and if it's a branch, is it taken. That requires accessing 2 very large tables that takes tens of picojoules. So you're actually spending more energy every instruction predicting branches than you are doing the instruction. And that you're not done at that point in time. You still actually have to read the instruction, you put it into buffers, read it out of buffers, rename the registers in it. Each of these processes is accessing a big table. Accessing big tables requires lots of energy, and that's why you wind up with this overhead which exceeds 99% on these out-of-order processors. In contrast, a GPU works more like this. We basically pick a thread, pull an instruction out of that thread, feed it down a pipeline, and as it goes down that pipeline, we read registers, and when we can, we read registers out of little registers that are right in front of the AOUs, to even avoid the energy cost of reading the full register bank. What you can see is there's no stages here to predict branches, no stages here to reorder instructions, no stages here to rename operands. The bulk of the energy actually goes into doing the instruction. Well, why is it that we can get away with this in a GPU and they have to do all of this complicated stuff in a CPU? And the answer is really simple. The net reason for all of this complicated stuff in a CPU is that when you do a load instruction, you don't know a priori whether that load instruction is going to take 3 clock cycles because it hits in the L1 cache, 20 or 30 clock cycles because it misses out to an L2 or L3 cache, or 100 clock cycles because you had to go all the way out to DRAM. And you basically have to keep trying to fill that 4-wide pipeline with useful instructions in the shadow of 100 clock cycle cache miss. And to do that, you have to basically look way ahead of the missing instruction to find independent work to feed the pipeline. Now, the average code has a branch instruction every 5 instructions. So if you have to look out 100 instructions ahead to find useful work to do while waiting for that cache miss to complete, you're having to look through many branches, which means you need a very accurate branch predictor. And then you basically have to, speculating through those branches, find independent work, rename their registers because you now have multiple copies of the registers representing their state at different points in this instruction sequence. Do these instructions all out of order, and then when you commit them at the end of the pipeline, put them all back into order. A huge amount of work to solve this one simple problem of not being able to predict the latency of a load instruction. GPUs solve the problem a different way, and it's the right way to solve it if you have parallelism. Because if you have parallelism, switching threads is a great way to tolerate latency. So the GPU assumes that if it does a memory operation, it's going to hit in its cache. If it misses in the cache, it just switches to a different thread. We very often have many tens of threads ready to go at a given point in time. So if one thread misses, we just grab another thread, run it, and when the cache miss comes back, that thread that missed is now eligible to run again. There's no need to run instructions of out of order. There's no need to miss, to speculate through branches and perhaps have to deal with the consequences of mispredicting. It's a very energy efficient way of hiding memory latency by multi-threading. There was a Stanford PhD thesis done a little while ago comparing the relative energy costs of different sort of speed of processors. And what it showed, this is sort of the Pareto optimal frontier of performance versus energy, is that you pay very steeply, these curves get very very steep, to get performance. And it's only at the highest performance that you actually need out-of-order cores. In fact, if you need an out-of-order core, it might as well be a two-issue or four-issue out-of-order core. The one-issue out-of-order core never hit the Pareto optimal frontier. That's this line here. In the entire range that it runs, you're actually better off with an in-order core of comparable or slightly greater issue rate. Those are the blue lines. So the message here is simple. If you can get parallelism, it both solves this problem of unpredictable memory load latency, and it's simply more efficient to have cores that don't try to reorder things and have more of them. So if we you sort of simplify things a lot, if we have what we call throughput cores that are optimized for absolute throughput instructions per watt rather than single thread performance instructions per second, we can get down very close to a 50-50 rate. You know, we're going to be 30 picojoule per op, and 15 picojoules is going into the payload arithmetic. 15 picojoules is going into overhead. Once we get to that point, we now have to worry about the next big source of energy that gets consumed in computer systems, which is data movement. It turns out if you have a really inefficient processor, data movement doesn't matter because you're burning a nanojoule per, you're doing a one picojoule add, burning a nanojoule in overhead. You don't care that it took 100 picojoules to actually move the data for the add. But if you get down to the point where the bulk of your energy is actually going to doing the arithmetic, now you do care about communication. And to give you the idea, I'll show you another cartoon of a chip. Here again, much larger than actual size, is a 64-bit double precision floating point unit. This is a 28 nanometer chip, and at 28 nanometers, the double precision op is about 20 picojoules per operation. But it turns out that much like children or pets, it's cheap to get a floating point unit, and it's expensive to keep it fed and take care of it. That's sort of illustrated here in that to feed a floating point unit, I need to give it three 64-bit things every cycle, an instruction and two input operands, and I need to take away a 64-bit thing every cycle, its result. So I basically have to move 256 bits around every cycle. And so even if those 256 bits come very close, they have to only travel a single millimeter of wire to get to the floating point unit, that's more energy than doing the floating point operation. And of course, those bits didn't materialize magically at the ends of those wires. They came from somewhere. They're typically read from a register or from a small cache array. And even a very small SRAM, about the size we use to build our register files, takes 50 picojoules to read the 256 bits. So it actually takes 2.5 times as much energy to read the operands from the register file as it does to do the floating point operation. And then you're up to sort of, you know 3.5-4 times as much energy if you actually had to move them a millimeter as well. The situation gets far worse if I have to go to the other end of the chip to get them. Now it's 50 times as much energy to traverse to the opposite corner of the chip. And if I go off the chip, it's hundreds of times more energy. Whether it's an efficient off-chip link, and another order of magnitude if I actually have to do a DRAM read out of an SDDR DRAM. So one thing we do at NVIDIA is when we start out designing our processors, we make up a list of what everything costs. And this actually came from a talk I gave a number of years ago at NVIDIA, where I pointed out that we were building GPUs and then kind of plugging them in and finding out how much power they dissipated, often with rude shocks. I pointed out this was sort of like going to the grocery store and throwing things into your shopping cart without looking at the price tags. And then you get to the checkout counter and you either need to negotiate a loan or you need to turn around and put a lot of things back on the shelves. So we actually started a process where we meticulously figured out what everything cost. This became known as a shopping list, which is a little bit of a misnomer. It really should be the energy list. And now as we assemble our processor, we can sort of predict how much things are going to cost. It's also interesting to look at how things scale on this shopping list as you go from 40 nanometer technology to 10 nanometer technology. And the voltage here does scale slightly, although not very much. The things that involve logic, like an arithmetic unit, As we're scaling this sort of factor of 10 in line width, are scaling a factor of 6 or 7 or so, say for the double precision footing multiply add in the read of an SRAM. But things that involve communication aren't scaling nearly as well. The cost of sending 256 bits 10 millimeters is only scaling by less than a factor of 2. So communication dominates machines that have low overhead today, and they're going to dominate far more in the future. So how can we solve that problem? This is really where better circuits come in. It turns out that if you took a class studying digital electronics and you assigned them to dissipate as much power as possible moving a bit from one place to another, they would have trouble doing better or worse, depending on how you think about it, than what we do today, where the standard signaling convention today is we basically connect a signal to the power supply to signal a 1, and we connect it to ground to signal a 0. That's actually an enormous amount of energy. That's enough energy to fry a cow, to simply move a bit from one end of a chip to another. And you don't have to. So on this chart, this is from another Stanford PhD thesis. This basically compares signaling frequency with power dissipation. FSI is full swing interconnect. That's what I just described, basically using the power supply, typically 1 volt to send a 1 and ground to send a 0. It's around 200 femtojoules per bit millimeter, and is horribly inefficient. If you start to come up with efficient methods of signaling, you can get down into the sort of 20 to 30 femtojoule per bit millimeter range. In fact, we just had a paper at the International Solid State Circuits Conference where we reported on 14 femtojoule per bit millimeter, actually measured on an operating GPU. We actually put the test article for this on a Pascal GPU so we could actually test the signaling in the presence of real noise. It's actually not used in the GPU. It's a test site on a production GPU. There's another issue that happens when you signal off-chip. Here the figure of merit isn't femtojoules per bit millimeter, it's typically picojoules per bit, and the reason is you're typically launching into a 50-ohm transmission line, and so your energy to first approximation is independent of distance, up into the point that you need to have a repeater because you've attenuated the signal down. But typical high-speed SerDes, for example, for a PCI Express link off of a GPU, are around 10 picojoules per bit. Modern DRAM interfaces are worse. They're around 20 picojoules per bit because they're particularly poorly, the standard actually is particularly poorly thought out, and you have to burn a lot of power to overcome noise sources that could have been avoided. It turns out you can do it more than an order of magnitude better than that. This is a test chip that we reported at the International Solid State Circuits Conference in 2013, where we are dissipating a half a picojoule per bit, so roughly a factor of 20 better than a typical SerDes, at the same rate. This is 20 gigabits per second, signaling over, on the order of 100 millimeters of trace on a package. And it's really the combination of a couple things. One is co-design of the channel with the signaling, so we don't need heroic equalization to overcome, for example, the point discontinuities caused by things like vias in the transmission line. But also a very clever circuit, which is actually a simple one. We simply charge a capacitor up every cycle, and then we discharge it either sort of right side up or upside down to send a 1 or a 0. And this has a nice property that it pulls the same amount of current out of the power supply every cycle, whether you're sending a 1 or a 0. And so it eliminates this phenomenon called simultaneous switching noise that happens in a lot of digital systems, where the current you draw from the supply depends on the polarity of the signal that you're sending. And hence, we can actually do single-ended signaling and get noise performance comparable to people who use differential signaling. That essentially doubles our bandwidth per unit edge of a die. So if I view the challenge of getting to an exaflop of sustained performance on a real application within 20 megawatts, and I view that the problem is, once we get rid of the overhead, the problem is really one of communication, I can view the problem as needing to fix two things. The total today is for the set of applications I used to draw this chart, is 77 picojoules per flop. To get to the 20 megawatt number, I need to get that number under 20 picojoules per flop. Now, the way I calculate this number is I basically multiply two curves together and then integrate. So the first curve is the demand curve, and that's basically on the left axis, bytes per flop, and is shown by the green curve here. And that's basically for this set of applications, I need to get 8 bytes per flop, basically one floating point word for every floating point operation out of my registers, 1K things, registers L1 cache kind of level. Out of an L2 cache, which might be 32K, I need to get 2 bytes per flop. Basically, every fourth operation, I need to fetch something from a 32K byte sized unit, and so on out to a megabyte, 32 megabytes, gigabyte, and so on. So the amount of bandwidth I need, the amount of bandwidth I need drops off because of locality of reference. I can basically get reuse of some of these operands. But while the locality is dropping off, the expense is increasing. And so there are two curves shown here. The cost curve here is picojoules per byte. How many picojoules does it take to fetch a byte from, this is the blue curve, from 1K, from 32K, 1 meg, and so on. And as you get out to the 1 meg and 32 meg, this is entirely communication cost. The 1K and 32K, it's basically that 50 picojoules to read 256 bits on chip. So you have about, say, a quarter of a picojoule, or 0.2 picojoules per bit. But out here, it becomes that femtojoule per bit millimeter of a signaling on chip to get there. With better architecture and better circuits, I can reduce the cost, the blue line. So when I multiply the blue line by the green line and sum up the points over this, instead of getting to 77, I can get to 18. I can basically get down to under 20 megawatts per exaflop simply by doing better architecture and circuits to reduce the cost of feeding things. But let me talk a little bit about how to reduce demand as well. And this really gets to this point about processors not getting any faster, just getting wider, as I said before. And so as the processors get wider, to program them, we have to program in parallel. Now, there's some people who are just deathly afraid of parallel programming. And this is typically for one of two reasons. The first reason, which is probably a good reason to be afraid, is that they have some huge code that they don't completely understand, which is serial. And it's a known hard problem to try to convert a serial code into a parallel code. But it's actually not a hard problem to write parallel codes. So just to give you an idea of how simple it is, here is an extremely parallel code. It's a fragment of a molecular dynamics code. And most problems are inherently parallel because they're operating over large sets of objects, in this case, sets of molecules, who in turn have sets of neighbors, which in turn have sets of forces that you're applying. And so you can basically do all of this work inherently in parallel. So here I basically express by saying, for every molecule in my set, maybe I have a billion molecules, so I now have a billion-fold parallelism going. And I say, for every neighbor of this molecule, and typically there's a range, and you've produced a neighbor list of molecules within that range, and typical molecule may have 1,000 neighbors, so now I have a trillion-fold parallelism. Then I'm going to say for every force, and I typically have a handful of forces, maybe 4 or 5. I'm going to have, weak and strong interactions, I'm going to have van der Waals forces, electrostatic forces. I'll apply the rules for those. And then I simply say the force of the molecule is a reduced sum of the forces from the neighbors. And there's another little fragment of code that's even simpler. I don't have here, which basically says for every molecule, push it by the amount of accelerate it by the force and push it by its velocity. But this is really simple to understand. Now, it's simple to understand for a couple reasons. I basically expressed all of the available parallelism. I didn't try to, if I had 1,000 processors, I didn't worry that I had a trillion-fold parallelism and I needed to basically do a billion things serially and then 1,000 of those in parallel. I expressed all the parallelism. I left it to some other thing to decide which of those tasks happen in space, in parallel, and which happen in time, serially. And so I'm not worried about the size of the machine, the size of its memories at different stages, staging the molecules up and down the storage hierarchy. That's a problem for a mapper, not for the programmer. I also don't worry about synchronization. The synchronization here is explicit, or just to say implicit, in the reduction of this molecule. I have to basically have the molecules in the neighbors before I compute the force, and I have to compute the force before I can finish this sum over all of these things. And so it's data dependencies sequencing this, and so I don't get in trouble with synchronization. Now, there are some people who like to make life difficult, and they compete in the obfuscated C code competition every year and things like that. and they write code that tends to look like this. And these are things that you should never do writing a parallel program. You shouldn't have to fork threads, right? Some piece of software should be deciding how many threads are needed to handle your program and handling forking and terminating threads. You shouldn't have to lock things, right? You shouldn't acquire a lock, manipulate some structure, and unlock it. This is error prone. Jim Laris, who's now Dean of Engineering at EPFL, at the time he was a researcher at Microsoft Research, wrote a code to find synchronization errors in programs at Microsoft, and sort of understandably it found errors in every program they ran it on. It was Windows operating system and things like that. What surprised people was even their best programmers made synchronization errors, and actually one of the most common ones was you would acquire a lock, manipulate a data structure and release a lock, except it was the wrong lock, right? In all of these cases, things were not properly encapsulated so that there was no check that the lock you acquired was the one for the data structure you were manipulating. And it's easy to get it wrong. And you also shouldn't be sending explicit messages, right, where you shouldn't say, okay, send this message with this tag to some process ID on a distant node. That should be managed by the higher-level system. So in fact, this is something I learned very much when I was a youth soccer coach. And it's a question of people being a team player and playing their position. When I was a youth soccer coach, the most common word of encouragement I'd get from the sideline is, don't steal the ball from her, she's on your team. And it's a question of sort of you're playing your position and letting the other players play their positions. And in this particular game, there are three positions. They're the programmer position, the tools position, and the architecture position. And they all have certain roles. In the programmer position, the role is to express all of the available parallelism, to express an abstract notion of locality, and to come up with really good algorithms for solving the problem. It's explicitly not to do the mapping. That's the tool's job. The tool position is to map the four alls in time and space, basically to decide how much parallelism to unroll in time and how much in space, to map the molecules across the memories, both across the nodes and, more importantly, up and down the storage hierarchy. The energy cost of fetching data from a remote node is only 3 times higher than the energy cost of fetching it from your local DRAM. The energy cost of fetching it from your local DRAM is 1,000 times higher than the energy cost of reading it from an L1 cache. So it's really important to stage up and down the storage hierarchy. And the role of the architecture is to get out of the way, to expose the storage hierarchy and have good mechanisms, but not to dictate any policy, to give the tools maximum freedom. Now, to be true, when you look at why teams fail, teamwork and any sort of group of people, you have to build a organization which is based on respect and trust. And I think that the respect and trust relationship of this era was often in jeopardy, and that a lot of programmers neither respect nor trust their tools. And this is something for those of us who develop tools we need to work on. What we're working on doing is actually developing target-independent tools so that the programmer can play their role. And tools, along with augmentation in the form of mapping directives from the programmer, will fill that in. And this is why you need to do that. This is a task graph from one step of S3D, which is a combustion code written at Sandia Laboratories. It's actually the one that was in the upper right corner of one of my first slides, doing the clean engine simulation. Each of the boxes here is a computation that needs to run. The edges represent the dependencies between those tasks. Human beings are not well suited to schedule something like this, but tools are. In collaboration with Stanford and with help from Sandia, we've been developing a system called Legion. I'm going to sort of skip through this animation, which basically you write the program. That's the programmer's role. The Legion runtime analyzes this program with this abstract notion of locality based on regions with input from the mapper, and the optimization tools are really in the form of what goes into the mapper, and produces the schedule, and it produces far better code. I'm going to skip over the data model since Andrew just gave me the time warning. I'll refer people to the paper if they're interested. I want to get to the results. It produces far better results than manual scheduling does. It's one of these things where people said, oh, I don't think the tools can do as well as I can. In fact, the tools are beating the smart human programmers optimizing by hand with strong incentives. So they took a 100,000-line Fortran program and ported it to Legion. Actually, most of the effort was porting it from Fortran to C++, which is the underlying Legion code. Getting it to run the first time on one machine took a lot of effort to do this port, but then it was on the order of a couple days' effort to do the next port, which is basically just doing the remapping. And what they found is that it was 6 times faster than the manually ported, manually scheduled version. Although a better comparison would be the sort of 2 to 3 times better comparing to the OpenACC version, which was a better optimization of it. So what it shows is that if you turn good software tools loose, you can change the demand curve, this byte per flop curve, the green curve. And by doing that, we can basically get another factor of 2. The architecture and circuits got us from 77 picojoule per flop to 18. We can get to 9 by basically, you know, getting more reuse out of our data by using a better mapper, not asking the programmer to do this mapping, but having the compiler do it. So let me wrap up and leave you with a couple thoughts. The first is we're in an age of power-limited computing. From your cell phone to your supercomputer, perf per watt is performance. And so the goal is to make things energy efficient. If you make them energy efficient, since you have a fixed amount of energy there, by definition, faster. One way of doing that is to build throughput cores that are optimized for performance per watt, not for single-thread performance. And by using multi-threading to hide latency rather than complicated out-of-order processors, we're able to eliminate most of the overhead energy that modern single-thread processors have. Once we've driven the overhead energy down, our energy is dominated by data movement. And we can attack this on 2 levels. The first is by better circuits. We can cut by more than an order of magnitude the fixed constant here, which is the cost of moving a bit, 1 millimeter, from 200 femtojoule per bit millimeter to less than 20. And then what we can do is, using optimized software like Legion to do the mapping of our programs, we can get better reuse out of each level of the storage hierarchy and cut that in half again. The machines we're building today, you know, from the ones that go in our cell phones to the ones in our supercomputer, are all parallel. And parallel programming is actually really simple if it's done at the right level, if the programmer plays their position and doesn't try to do things like create threads or acquire locks, but instead expresses parallelism in an abstract way, locality in an abstract way. We need to basically move to this model of target-independent programming, or it's going to just be an insurmountable labor task to try to build the parallel programs that we need. The final thing, and I didn't really get much time to talk about it today, other than in passing at the beginning of the talk, but it's something I'm actually spending most of my time on, is that machine learning, when I talked about our effort with automobiles to reduce the 1.2 million traffic deaths, is revolutionizing computing, not just for automated driving, but for almost every task. And I've rarely seen a field which has obsoleted more people's career work, from speech recognition to computer vision to things like deciding what ads get placed. People who've spent 30-year careers coming up with the best manually designed feature detectors for computer vision find their work obsoleted because you can have, you know, some sophomore train a neural network and come up with better feature detectors than the ones they spent their career developing. It has an insatiable demand for flops for training. And then it also has a very high demand for operations, typically fixed point operations, for inference, because while it has much higher quality feature detectors than the manually designed sifter hog feature detectors in computer vision or the phoneme detectors of speech recognition systems, they are way more expensive computationally than the manually designed ones. And so it makes another great opportunity for us computer architects to come up with clever solutions to delivering those operations at a power budget that people can afford. So thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to take a few questions. Yeah, the short answer is not really. So variability is probably the bigger of the two. As we scale things, a number of guard bands we have to put in our designs wind up increasing. The difference between the worst case speed of a device, for example, and the nominal speed gets larger. And so we wind up doing techniques. We have one that's been put in our current GPUs, where we actually have them automatically adjust their clock rate to match the speed of the devices to basically take out the what would otherwise be wasted energy for that guard band. For reliability, things are actually getting better, which is something people don't appreciate. We, you know, both for our supercomputers, we have to meet, we have to run these machines with 50,000 GPUs, long enough to, many of these simulations will take weeks to run and then produce a result that we know is correct. We have very stringent requirements for both detectable, uncorrectable errors, and the really stringent requirement is for, escapes, basically silent errors. But it turns out that the underlying technology gets better every generation. The raw fit rate of both a flip-flop and an SRAM cell is better each time you reduce line width. And it seems counterintuitive because there's sort of less energy remembering the bit to be flipped, but its cross-section goes down faster than the energy, so actually the fit rate goes down, and the technology inherently is more reliable as time goes on. Now, we put more of them together on a chip, which makes the net fit rate go up, so we have to do things to deal with that. But actually, the problem is easier.
So what would you say about FPGAs, and how do you think they'll compare to superprocessors like GPUs?
That's a really good question. So FPGAs really have two separate things on them. They have some hardwired blocks, typically hardwired arithmetic units and hardwired memories. Then they have seas of logic that are built with lookup tables. The hardwired blocks are very good. I mean, they're competitive. The energy to do a single precision or double precision flop in an FPGA, if it has that hardwired block, is comparable to that in a GPU. The problem is everything else is down by a factor between 30 and 100. We've actually done some experiments on this to quantify that number. Building logic out of LUTs is really, really inefficient. And so when you build a computation engine, remember, it's not the arithmetic that matters. It's moving data around and it's all this other stuff. And so you're down by a factor of 30 or 100 on the other stuff, which even if it was only half, is now, sort of, 30 times half. So you're, does that work out to 70%? No, it's worse than that, like 90%. And then the other problem is that it's really hard to program them, right? You basically have to write Verilog to get good performance out of an FPGA. Now people are doing some work on high level synthesis, whether you're starting with C++ or System C, or OpenCL, but there's still a big gap there on the programmability. So I think the combination of the very high overhead on things realized with LUTs and the programmability is going to limit the applicability of FPGAs to things where you're doing stuff that doesn't need normal arithmetic. I think actually bioinformatics is a great example of this. If you're operating with two-bit base pairs and the fundamental operation you want to do is a dynamic programming computation, but again, the FPGA will be down by a factor of 100 from an ASIC, but unless somebody builds that ASIC, you're probably going to be better than somebody trying to emulate that with, 16 to 32-bit arithmetic operations.
Bill, this is really a good talk. I really enjoyed it. My question is, you mentioned in the beginning, you mentioned this pervasive parallelism, but your parallelism seems still emphasized on computing. What do you think about concurrent data access? Do you think we should start to thinking about to concurrently or parallelly to support the data access?
Well, first, to do the computing, you had to access the data. I mean, one of the big points I hope I made is that supplying the data to the arithmetic units costs more than actually doing the arithmetic operation. And so to carry out, for example, a big molecular dynamics simulation, you've got a billion molecules spread over, maybe 10,000 GPUs in a large computer. You're fetching, 10,000 molecules in parallel, actually more than that because each GPU has many different SMs all fetching. It's probably 100,000 molecules being fetched in parallel each cycle by having that data set distributed over the nodes of the machine. So your parallel data goes in hand in hand with parallel arithmetic.
So if that is the issue, what is the technology challenge for the concurrent or parallel memory?
But I think the parallel memory you have is just you have a bunch of memories, attached in a hierarchy to each one of these nodes. I'd probably have to think about it, but I don't know that there's a vast difference we need from what we have today.
Maybe a similar question, but a slightly different one. You described a lot about sort of the compute subsystem of a computer. But a computer system's a lot more than that. You've got networking, you've got I/O, all the things that talk to the user. Do you have a similar extension of this vision about how this subsystem fits into the bigger picture of what the users interact with?
Yeah, that would be a whole different talk. In fact, being from a graphics company, we actually spend a lot of our time dealing with the part that talks to the user, and actually in both directions. The human-computer interface is a huge deal for us, and in fact, right now we're very focused on building things which are very effective at driving various virtual reality systems, which we see as the ultimate way of dealing with the user. And also on the input side, both getting information from users, but also from the environment. So for example, in the example of a self-driving car, it turns out even in the most ambitious levels of those, where, you know, for ambitious virtual reality systems, we're talking about, you know, 8K displays for each eye that we're gonna drive at 100 frames per second, the actual bandwidth of that is quite low compared to the bandwidth demands elsewhere in the system. Similarly, even in the self-driving cars, we've got 12 cameras. That's a relatively small bandwidth demand. 12 cameras is only a few gigabytes per second of bandwidth. And so what we find is that even the very demanding I/O applications, the I/O required is actually pretty small. There's a big networking requirement, but it's actually, as we build these big systems, it's connecting the nodes of our machine together. Whenever we neck down to actually connect into a broader internet, the bandwidths actually drop way down again. We very often will have, you know, hundreds of gigabytes to terabytes per second in these internal networks, dropping to, you know, at most tens of gigabytes per second at the internet working level. Yeah, well, I hate to think of these things as being von Neumann because they don't have the von Neumann bottleneck, right? I mean, they are parallel machines. But True North is a completely different thing. So let me talk about two different classes that talk about True North. So the first is accelerators that are specialized for deep learning. And I actually have a paper at ISCA this year on that topic. And so I think that it sort of falls into the category I had when I showed special purpose logic, that, you know, sort of a CPU running in scalar mode is nanojoules per instruction. A CPU running in sort of AVX SIMD mode is 100 picojoules per instruction. A GPU is around 30. Special purpose logic can get to around 3. And so if you have a particular task you want to carry out, and for machine learning inference tasks, it's a very well-defined, you know, convolutional and fully connected layer evaluation. You can get an order of magnitude more performance by specializing logic for that. Much as we specialize logic today to, for example, do rasterization and texture filtering and compositing for graphics, and to do both still and motion coding of images for our various mobile devices. And so specialization is a huge lever to apply. Now, in the field of neural networks, I'm much more impressed with accelerators like the Dianao chips that have all come out of INRIA and the Chinese Academy of Sciences that basically accelerate what I'll call sort of conventional neural networks, than things like True North, which tries to accelerate the spiking model of neural networks. And the reason for that is the conventional neural networks win the ImageNet competition every year. They actually work on getting better than human performance at tasks like both image recognition, classification detection, and the like, as well as speech recognition. The Baidu Deep Speech 2 beats human at recognizing speech, whereas the spiking networks haven't reached that level yet. In many ways, it's like trying to build an airplane by watching a bird flap its wings and then making an airplane flap its wings. Just because the brain communicates its neurons with spikes doesn't mean that's necessarily the right way of building it. A specialized engine to do inference in neural networks.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
I actually got unplugged in the thing.
So I think, I don't know if Shan or Fabian wanted to come down and say any words. Did you want to say anything, or shall we just sort of?